भगवत्यखिलात्मनि सद्विशोऽस्ति शिवपन्था योगिनां ब्रह्मसिद्धये।
Yujyamanaya.
Being performed.
Bhaktiya.
Devotional service.
Bhagavati.
Towards the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Okila Atmani.
The super soul.
Sadvishaha.
Like.
Asti.
There is.
Shivaha.
Auspicious.
Pantaha.
Path.
Yogina.
Of the yogis.
Brahma Siddhaye.
For perfection in self-realization.
Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. Perfection, of course this is, if anybody's not familiar with what we're reading here, Lord Kapiladeva is beginning his instructions to his mother Devahuti. He says, perfection in self-realization cannot be attained by any kind of yogi unless he engages in devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, for that is the only auspicious path. Purport. That knowledge and renunciation are never perfect unless joined by devotional service is explicitly explained here. Nayujyamanaya means without being dovetailed. When there is devotional service, then the question is where to offer that service. Devotional service is to be offered to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is the super soul of everything. For that is the only reliable path of self-realization or Brahma realization. The word Brahma Siddhaye means to understand oneself to be different from matter, to understand oneself to be Brahman. The Vedic words are Aham Brahmasmi. Brahma Siddhi means that one should know that he is not matter. He is pure soul. There are different kinds of yogis, but each yogi is supposed to engage in self-realization or Brahman realization. It is clearly stated here that unless one is fully engaged in the devotional service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, one cannot have easy approach to the path of Brahma Siddhi. In the beginning of the second chapter of Srimad Bhagavatam, it is stated that when one engages himself in the devotional service of Vasudeva, spiritual knowledge and renunciation of the material world automatically become manifest. Thus a devotee does not have to try separately for renunciation or knowledge. Devotional service itself is so powerful that by one's service attitude, everything is revealed. It is stated here, Shiva Panta. This is the only auspicious path for self-realization. The path of devotional service is the most confidential means for attaining Brahman realization. That perfection in Brahman realization is attained through the auspicious path of devotional service indicates that the so-called Brahman realization, or realization of the Brahma Jyoti effulgence, is not Brahma Siddhi. Beyond that Brahma Jyoti, there is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In the Upanishads, a devotee prays to the Lord to kindly put aside the effulgence, Brahma Jyoti, so that the devotee may see within the Brahma Jyoti the actual eternal form of the Lord. Unless one attains realization of the transcendental form of the Lord, there is no question of bhakti. Bhakti necessitates the existence of the recipient of devotional service and the devotee who renders the devotional service. Brahma Siddhi through devotional service is realization of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The understanding of the effulgent rays of the body of the Supreme Godhead is not the perfect stage of Brahma Siddhi or Brahman realization. Nor is the realization of the Paramatma feature of the Supreme Person perfect. For Bhagavan, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is Akhilatma. He is the Supersoul. One who realizes the Supreme Personality realizes the other features, namely the Paramatma feature and the Brahman feature. And that total realization is Brahma Siddhi. This is a radical statement, and Srila Prabhupada has chosen to translate it in a radical way. Some other person may not be satisfied with this. He may even complain from a grammatical point of view that Nanyato Stishadak Shivakpanta. Literally, the words could be understood to mean there is no more auspicious path. You could argue that, oh, there can be other auspicious paths, but there's no other auspicious path more auspicious. Prabhupada takes it even more radically in his interpretation, his choice of translation of the verse. He said, there is no other auspicious path. All the other paths are not auspicious. So the grammarian might argue. But actually, Srila Prabhupada has caught the real sense of what Kapila Deva is saying. Even if somebody wants to quibble on the basis of grammar, grammatical understanding, Prabhupada has actually understood the import of Lord Kapila Deva's instruction. And it is consistent with what else the Bhagavatam says, and it is consistent with what the original Vedas say. In the beginning of the Bhagavatam, in the very beginning, second verse of the first chapter of the Bhagavatam, it is announced, Dharma Projita Kaita Votra. In this book, this is actually the Mangalacharna of the Bhagavatam. In Mangalacharna, or an auspicious invocation of any text, basically three things can be done. Ishtadeva Namaskar, you can offer obeisance, respects to your worshipable deity. One should offer respects to his Lord for the success of his endeavor. And secondly, you can offer blessings to your readers or promise them some benefit from studying your book. Just like in the Kavya Prakasha, the textbook on the science of poetry, written by Mamata, Kashmiri Brahmana, maybe in the 13th century AD, he wrote, or 9th century AD, he wrote this book. And in the beginning of the book, he announces, the benefits of studying poetry? Art and J, you can get money from studying, from being an expert poet. You can make some good money. Yashase, you can become famous. And other benefits from studying poetry. This is his way of encouraging and blessing his readers. You know, read, study this textbook I'm writing on poetry, you can become rich and famous. So this ashirvad, offering of blessings or benefits to the readers, is also part of auspicious invocation. Third thing you can do in the invocation is explain what the book's about. Announce your topic. So that's what Bhagavatam is doing in this statement. Dharma Projita Kaita Votra. This book, it's actually stating it negatively. What the Bhagavatam doesn't talk about. This book rejects all versions of deceptive religion. Kaitava Dharma. Now, Dharma doesn't mean religion in the sense of denomination, sectarian belief, although in the modern language it does. We talk about Christian Dharma or Sikh Dharma. This is modern use of the word. In the original use of the word Dharma, there isn't different Dharmas. There's only one Dharma. For the Jiva soul, he has one purpose, to serve God. As Krishna Das Kaviraj, paraphrasing the instructions of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, writes in his Chaitanya Charitamrita, Jiva Swarup Hoy Nitya Krishna Das. The actual identity, the proper identity of the spirit, living spirit soul, is that he is eternally servant of Krishna. That is his dharma. Whether he calls himself a Presbyterian or an Episcopalian, a Shaivite or a Vaishnava, that is insignificant. That is not his real dharma. His real dharma is he is eternal servant of God. Whatever he thinks God is, that doesn't matter. What he is what his real identity is. What he thinks about himself is superficial, can change. He can think himself a Shaivite today and a Vaishnav tomorrow, or vice versa. But what he really is doesn't change. That's dharma. That's what dharma really means. So what it seems like a funny term, kaitava dharma, cheating dharma. That means not real dharma. Misrepresentation of what the duty of man is. All misrepresentations of the actual responsibility of human life are rejected. They will not be taken under serious consideration here in Srimad Bhagavatam. Dharma Kaitava Projita, completely abandoned or completely rejected here. That is the announcement of what the book is not about. It's not about any mundane conception of religion. In his commentary, so you may say, well, Srila Prabhupada, he was very radical. He had his own agenda. He wanted to push Krishna, and he didn't like the impersonalists. And he was really down on the impersonalists, and every chance he got to, he said something bad about the Advaita devotees. And this was Srila Prabhupada's personal prejudice. You can say that. But it wasn't just him. You can go back to Srila Sridhar Swami, who is the oldest known commentator on the Srimad Bhagavatam. In the 14th century he may have lived. Bhagavatam was there before, but we don't have older commentaries that still exist. Sridhar Swami is accepted by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu as a perfectly reliable authority on the message on what is the purport of Srimad Bhagavatam. In commenting on that same statement, Sridhar Swami says, Kaitava Dharma means everything, even including the conception of the oneness of the Jiva soul and the Paramatma. This idea of absolute non-difference between God and the finite soul. This is also cheating. And that is also rejected by the Bhagavatam. This impersonal conception that everybody is God and nobody is God. That the personality of God is not the real absolute truth, he's just Saguna Brahman, and he's also illusion. Our disagreement, our dissatisfaction with the Advaitavadis is not that they say that this world is Maya, illusion. We also agree that this material creation is illusion. It is not what it seems to be. My so-called living body is a dead lump of flesh. I'm alive inside it, but it's not me. And as to the extent that I identify with this dead lump of flesh, that is illusion. So my whole life, the whole contraption arrangement of material life is illusion. So we agree with the Advaita bodies. Brahma Satyam Jagam Mithya, the world is false. Although our exact understanding of that is different. How it's false is different, you know, we have a different idea. But generally we also agree the world is Maya. So we're also Maya bodies. We're also Maya bodies in that way. But the difference we see and the objection we have is that they go to the extent of saying that God is also Maya. But he's also an illusion, because the Supreme really doesn't have any form or any personality. The real Supreme is impersonal. This personality of Godhead is an illusion, just like my own material identity is an illusion. That I am an American, that's an illusion. I'm an American, you know, I was born in an American body, but who knows what I was in the previous life and what I'll be in the next life. I'm not really an American, that's illusion. Temporary identification. So identifying the Supreme Absolute Truth as Krishna, that's a convenient fiction, according to the Advaitavadis. But it's illusion. So we have every objection, and we refuse to respect their opinion, because they're saying that Krishna is also Maya. Krishna is saying in the Gita, Matat Parat Taram Manyat, there is nothing superior to me. And they're saying, well, the person who said that isn't really a person anyway. So we can disregard his opinion and take the absolute to be impersonal, ultimately. That's why we call them Mayavadis, and we take that in a derogatory sense. They say that God is also Maya. Sri Goswami was not a Mayavadi, although he may have officially belonged to the Advaitavad school of Shankara. But his opinions and his heart were completely personal. He was a great devotee of Lord Narasimhadev, Narasimha. And he was a thorough Vaishnava, pure Vaishnava. And his opinion is that Bhagavatam rejects all kinds of cheating religion, including this Advaitavad idea that everything is one, that the Supreme is ultimately not a person. That is rejected in the Bhagavatam. So it's not just Srila Prabhupada with an axe to grind. Srila Swami and all the Vaishnavas throughout history have the same complaint, the same disagreement with the Advaitavadis. It has been going on for thousands of years, this disagreement. Not that Srila Prabhupada is some, gets his own personal quirk, something in his psychology. Somebody did something to him in his childhood and therefore he's got this grudge. You know, just like Adolf Hitler had a difficult youth. You know, he fought in the First World War. He got poison gas in his face. Was dismissed as an invalid from the army. Then he was unemployed. He couldn't find any good work, living in poverty in Vienna. And he decided, in his frustration, that all the problems in the world were the fault of the Jews. And all we have to do is kill all the Jews. So he had a psychological problem, and he found, you know, a scapegoat for all the faults and all the causes of all the misery in the world. Don't think that Srila Prabhupada is another mundane person who had a grudge, some psychological problem, and therefore he blamed it all on the Mayavadis. Now, this is not some individual grudge. This goes back centuries, millennia. This disagreement, we cannot accept. Vyasadeva is not accepting it. In his declaration in the very beginning of the Bhagavatam, Dharma Kaitava Projita, we will not accept these cheating concepts of religion. Srila Sridhar Swami explains that means even the impersonalism of the Advaitavadis. Rejected. So Prabhupada's interpretation of this verse as meaning there is no other auspicious path is perfectly consistent with the spirit of the Srimad Bhagavatam, as explained by its standard commentators. It's not simply a twisted interpretation of Srila Prabhupada's own. Not in any way. Although the grammarians can quibble, when you actually understand the spirit of the Bhagavad Gita is perfectly consistent. The path of this impersonal path is not auspicious. If you think that you are completely non-different from the Supreme Lord, that is not a proper attitude of devotion. It is not a proper attitude of a yogi. You will not actually become one in union with the Supreme by insulting the Supreme. You're so great, but you have no personality. All religions of the world are declaring God is great. Allahu Akbar. There may not be an understanding of how God is great. That may be missing, but at least the recognition is there, is God is great. So what glorification of God is it to say you're not a person? You're a dead stone. You're nothing. This is insult, not glorification, not devotion. It's the opposite of devotion. It's the worst kind of aparad, to denigrate the personality of the Supreme and try to drag him down to a level of impersonality. So therefore it is correct understanding. There, all the other paths besides the path of actual devotion to God, if there is no spirit of loving devotion to the Supreme Lord, then there is no question of spiritual progress. There is no real yoga, no real path of yoga without pure devotion. There may be different ideas of what God is. The Supreme Lord Vishnu has so many different forms, so many different moods in which his devotees worship him. And someone may worship some demigods, which is not understood to be erroneous. The other devatas like Maheshwara and Brahma, Indra, and others that may be worshipped, Surya, Ganesh, they are servants of God. They're not themselves the Supreme Lord. But even their devotees, at least they have some spirit of devotion. And certainly the other Vaishnavas who may be worshipping Lord Ramachandra, Lord Narasimha, Varaha, we consider that we are Vaishnavas, they are Vaishnavas. They just have a different, they worship the Lord in a different form, in a different mood. And even we can recognize the Christians, the Muslims, the Jews, they're also in a sense Vaishnavas. They're worshipping the one Supreme Lord, although they have their own concept of who that God is. But without some devotion, and pure devotion to the Lord, there is no real spiritual status. There is no real practice of yoga. You cannot connect with the Supreme unless you love him. The Supreme cannot be dealt with in ordinary ways. He's not just another person you do business with. He's not another customer or another employer or employee, another person to exploit or be exploited by. He doesn't deal in that way. The Lord can only be dealt with, you can only have a relationship with the Supreme on the basis of love. He doesn't deal on other bases. He doesn't do mundane business. He's not a profit maker. And he's not interested to engage in mundane business with you or with anybody. Even those who are envious and demoniac, they may approach the Supreme Lord in a mundane way. Just like people in motor fashion, they fight things out. They have wars. Or if they're in the modern world, it's understood to be better business to just compete for money. You know, the business competition is the modern equivalent of the petty wars of the Middle Ages. It's business competition. So you're trying to beat out your competition, or in the older sense, you're trying to destroy your enemies and conquer on the battlefield. Either way, this is the manifestation of Rajoguna, trying to dominate, literally be the dominator by destroying your enemies. The Supreme Lord doesn't deal like that. Even when when people who consider themselves his enemies, the demons, who are declared enemies of God, like Hiranyakashipu. Hiranyaksha, his older brother, well, they were twins, but Hiranyaksha was born first, Hiranyakashipu was conceived first. But because if I have it right, because he was born first, Hiran Yaksha was considered older, although they were actually identical twins in the womb. So Hiranyaksha got himself killed first. He foolishly picked a fight with Lord Varahadev. But he had no hatred of Lord Varahadev. He just wanted to find someone he could fight with, an equal competitor. He went all over the universe and nobody wanted to fight with him. Nobody dared to fight with Hiranyaksha. He went to Varuna, who was a great warrior in his young days. But Varuna said, well, I'm old now, I don't fight anymore. So I'm sorry, you know, I concede. If you want to consider yourself the victor, I'm not going to try to fight with you. So even Lord Varuna refused to fight with Hiranyaksha. But he was finally advised, you want a person to fight against, go find Vishnu. And he's now within the Vasatala border, picking up the earth. You can find him there. So Hiranyaksha went to find Lord Varaha, and he had his battle, and he got himself killed. Not out of any great enmity, he was just looking for a good fight. But his brother, Hiranyakashipu, became the avowed enemy of this Vishnu who killed my brother. I have to destroy him. He's my enemy, and anybody who considers himself the devotee of Vishnu, I will destroy them. So here's Hiranyakashipu, declared enemy, deep in his heart. He has nothing but hatred for the personality of Godhead Vishnu. But Vishnu doesn't deal with him the way a person normally deals with an enemy. Lord Vishnu is controller of the universe. Either he can, by himself, do whatever needs to be done, or he can easily empower his servants to do the necessary. Here in Hiranyakashipu could have been disposed of very easily. Either some Indra could have been empowered to kill him, so that Hiranyakashipu kicked Indra out of his kingdom, and he took over heaven and the whole universe. Krishna could have empowered Indra to not let Hiranyakashipu do that, to defeat Hiranyakashipu in battle, but he didn't. Lord Vishnu let Hiranyakashipu conquer. And even that wasn't necessary. Just some force of nature. Krishna can empower, the Supreme Lord can empower the microbes to invade someone's body and kill them by disease. Who was it? Hamayun, the father of Akbar. He was a great warrior, very victorious in battle. And he was at the height of his power. And he was up in his Chandrashala, in his observatory above the palace. And he fell down the stairs, tripped down the stairs and died. And that's how Akbar became, at the age of 12, the king, the emperor. Accident, by quirk of nature. The Lord can arrange to dispose of his enemies. I'm not saying Hamayun was an enemy of God, I'm not saying that. But just, by arranging material nature to do something, so many unwanted people can be disposed of. The Lord doesn't have to appear himself. He doesn't even have to empower any special person. He can just have a disease, an earthquake, anything happen. Why didn't he dispose of Hiranyakashipu? Why did he let him do all this nonsense? Because he didn't consider Hiranyakashipu his enemy. He tolerated him. The Supreme Lord doesn't deal with us like we deal with each other. He has a transcendental attitude always. No one is his friend, and no one is his enemy. And when he even finally killed Hiranyakashipu, on the request of Prahlad, who received all the persecution of Hiranyakashipu, on Prahlad's request, Lord Narasimha agreed to give Hiranyakashipu salvation, liberation. So the very enemies who he kills get the highest blessings by being killed by the Lord. He doesn't have enemies. So we can't expect that we can deal with him as an ordinary competitor or an ordinary business partner. people approach God materialistically. Prahlad, that same boy who was delivered by Lord Narasimha and who asked for the salvation of his father, he made the statement that someone who goes to God to try to do, to make a profit, to make some exchange, Nasa Bhakta Savaivanik, he's not a devotee, he's an ordinary businessman trying to do business with God. That is not pure devotion. It may be considered some kind of devotion, but it is impure. And that is rejected. Kapila Devi is saying, actual devotion is the only auspicious path. Mixed devotion, or trying to do business with God, or trying to compete with God, or trying to eliminate God, either by fighting him in battle, or by trying to argue in philosophical terms that he's just Saguna Brahma, and denigrate, try to destroy him philosophically. This is no way can be considered devotion. No way can be considered auspicious. This is not progressive spiritual life. This is going in the opposite direction. It is committing apparat against the Supreme Lord. Although it's understood, as Rupa Goswami explains, Narada says, Tasmat kena apyupayena mana krishnin niveshayet. The key principle is, somehow or other, you should fix your mind on the Supreme, on Krishna, the Supreme Lord. Whatever you can do. And as Rupa Goswami says, in his definition of pure devotion, anyabhilashita shunyam, karma jnana adhyanavratam, anukulyena krishna anushilana bhakti uchyate, bhakti uttama, high class, perfect devotional service, pure devotional service, uttama bhakti, means to practice serving and thinking about the Supreme Lord, Krishna. It says Krishna, not specifically the name Krishna is used. And that devotional practice, it may not be fully developed, it may not be spontaneous, it may just be in practice, according to following guidance, rules and regulations of the scripture as explained to you by spiritual authorities. But even if you're just practicing, at least that devotional practice must be unmotivated, not motivated by any material idea. There should be no ulterior motives. Otherwise you're just doing business. You're trying to get a profit from God. But if you're willing to try to serve him simply for his pleasure, that can be considered pure devotional practice. Even if you don't have the actual purity that it requires to actually love God, you may not have developed actual love, but you have the intention to do it. The intention to dedicate your life for the service of God for his pleasure. Even that theoretical intention is the beginning of the practice of pure devotion. Further stipulation, jnana karma adi anavrita. You should not let the motives of material success, karma, or spiritual salvation, liberation. Material success or liberation should not be the controlling motive. It's not bad to want to be liberated so that we can serve Krishna freely, completely. Liberated from material attachments. Liberated from the cycle of birth and death. Then I can go back to Krishna's eternal abode if I get that liberation. So it's not wrong to want it. But we should want Krishna's service first. We should want to love Krishna first. And then if getting liberated will promote that purpose, okay. But it's not that the predominating purpose should be our liberation. Let me never get liberation. Let me go to hell if I have an opportunity to serve Krishna in that condition. But certainly, ordinary material success, even up to getting to the kingdom of heaven, or even to the position of Lord Brahma, we shouldn't be primarily motivated by any concept of material success. Certainly, that would be just a distraction or detrimental to the cultivation of pure devotion. And then the last condition is anukulina. The devotional practice should be favorable. Because demons, like Hiranyakashipu, like Jarasandha, like Shishupala, like Kamsa, they were thinking about Krishna constantly. Kamsa could not stop thinking about this Krishna who I heard from the Kashyavani that this eighth son of Devaki is going to kill me. He could never get that out of his mind. Day and night he was thinking about Krishna. Shishupala also, he couldn't get Krishna out of his mind. And also the tip of his tongue. He was constantly insulting Krishna. He had the blessing from Krishna. He can get away with insulting me 100 times. He can blaspheme me 100 times and I won't exert any retribution. Of course, he went beyond the limit. The 101st time he blasphemed Krishna, he got his head cut off at the Rajasuya sacrifice. But 100 times he got away with it. So he could not only stop thinking in a negative way about Krishna, he was always talking in a negative way about Krishna, blaspheming. That can't be counted as pure devotion because it's not anukulya, it's not favorable. It's constant thinking of God, but it's thinking about him as an enemy, in an offensive way. So devotion must be favorable, it must be not in an inimical mood. If you're thinking, why did you let this happen? You know, you allowed my loved one to get sick, to get old, to die. Why do you let these things happen? Even one Jewish theologian wrote a book when bad things happen to good people. And he tries to investigate or philosophically figure out, why does God let bad things happen to people who never did anything wrong? Because he doesn't understand the law of karma. People in the West don't understand that this is not our only life. We've lived previously in other bodies. And the reaction we're getting now, we seem to be innocent, but we're not innocent. We did something horrible in the previous life, and therefore we're suffering now. But without understanding that, that we live repeatedly in different bodies, and that the karma we acquire, the bad karma, good karma we acquire in a previous life follows us into the next. If you can't understand that, then you're in a quandary. Why does God let bad things happen to good people? Why does an infant who couldn't have done anything in this life bad, be born with a congenital disease and suffer and die at an early age? Why can that happen? Why does God let such things happen? So many innocent people die in wars, die in natural disasters. Why? Because they're not innocent, according to the actual understanding of the law of karma. They did things in the previous life that merit their suffering. But otherwise, you're forced to question that. And this serious theologian should be explaining the ways of God to man, not destroying our faith in God. But his argument was, either God is malicious or he's incompetent to let these things happen. Either he's not really in control and he can't stop bad things happening to good people, or he's bad and he likes to make good people suffer. That's the only conclusion he can come to. Not very good theology. If you end up, explaining in such a way that he looks bad. God isn't bad like that. If you can't understand God any better than that, don't present yourself as a theologian. You don't understand the ways of God, and you're not competent to explain them to anybody. So there's no way that any path of philosophy, any path of yoga, or any attempt at perfecting your life is going to be a success unless you have this actual Shuddha Bhakti, Uttama Bhakti. Unless you can at least practice with a basic theoretical understanding that you're actually the eternal servant of God, and that you should try to render service to Him. The business of your life should be to give pleasure to God, to glorify Him, and to serve Him in a personal way, for His pleasure, in a favorable way. Otherwise, there's no actual auspicious progress in life. That's actually what Kapila Deva was saying. And Prabhupada has brought that out very strongly in his translation of purport.
Hare Krishna.
Okay, so I'll stop there. Does anybody have any questions or comments?
Yeah. Just in the beginning of the lecture, you explained about the various dharmas. So when we get real information from Srimad Bhagavatam and other holy scriptures, especially Vedic scriptures, that
yes.
the only one dharma of human society or jiva is Sanatana Dharma. So why there are today so many different varieties of dharma available in the world, like Sikhism or Hinduism or...
Because we misuse dharma. We use dharma, you know, as a tool for destroying our enemies or for promoting our material life. Someone goes to church or he does a big yagya or he donates, you know, has a big puja done so that people will think he's very great. We make false show of religion to increase our material position or our reputation. Or we even use religion as a way to label our enemies. You know, because they're infidels, therefore they should be killed. You know, in order to promote the real religion, we should conquer this next kingdom and take it over and kill everybody who's an infidel. Using religion to label other people enemies and destroy them. Misuse of religion. Dharma used as a political tool, as a business tool. You know, it's not for that. It's for the service and glorification of God, but we misuse it, and therefore it becomes perverted. Not because there's anything wrong with dharma, but with the horrible things we do to dharma is what creates the corruption. Some people decide religion is bad, let's become atheists, because so many religious people abuse it in this way, therefore religion itself must be bad. But that's foolish. The real purpose of life is to become a pure servant of God, to realize your real identity as eternal servant of God. Atheism is no solution. You know, there's no auspiciousness in atheism. Does that answer the question, or
yes? But does this so-called dharma or religion are leading the human society towards the love of God?
In many cases, not. We have to test by result. A religion is good and can be accepted as authentic if it does lead its followers toward love of God. We have to judge by the result. There may be so many ways to approach God, so we can't be cut and dry and say it has to be this way and it can't be any other way. But we test by the result. You may have some way, I may think, well, to get to Munirka, you have to go down this road. Well, the Richard Wallaby may have a different idea. He may know some other way that's even shorter, but there's not much difference. So I let him try. If he can get me to Munirka, you know, within 25 minutes, I'll accept it. Like that. If someone can find love of God or promote love of God, get us closer to it by some means or other, fine. That can be accepted as bona fide religion. But when it goes in the opposite direction, when it makes people more materialistic and less faithful, then we have to say that kind of religion should be rejected. Mainly we have to be practical and see what, you know, see the results. Therefore, the Vedic culture is usually one of tolerance. People can have their own opinions. We're not going to force, you know, any particular philosophy or belief on anybody. You want to worship some deity or some rock or some tree, go ahead, you know, but be honest, you know, practice what you preach, don't be a hypocrite. So we can tolerate all different kinds of religion, but hypocrisy we won't tolerate. So it can be also to dharmas, but the dharma has to be honest and not actually atheistic. As far as we're concerned, the Advaitavad is atheistic. It's opposed to actual devotion to God. And therefore, we're so violently opposed to it. Because it's aparad. It's really atheism.
Okay.
Something else?
Yes, sir.
You have said that in
different ways we become enemies of God. Like just Ranyard speaking an equivalent competitor or in a way that we become enemy of the God like Hiranyakashipu.
Yes.
But you said that on philosophical plane also we try to regenerate God.
Yes.
So can you please explain that?
If you promote a philosophy that says that you're saying, according to the Upanishads, Ekam Advitiyam Brahma, the absolute truth is one without a second. And you take that to mean that there cannot be any, literally, that there cannot be any variety in God. He cannot have a form, because form means variety. If God is Shama, if he's dark blue, then he's not yellow and he's not pink. He's, you limited it to one color. And the very hardcore Advaitavadi will say, you cannot do that. God is not any particular color. He's no color. He has no shape, no form. Because form means material variety. It means duality. And there is no duality in the Supreme. That is worse than Hiranyaksha's picking up a club and trying to smash out the grains of Lord Varahadev. He's trying to literally kill God with his physical brute force. But the philosophers who try to negate the personality of Godhead by the grammatical tricks and philosophical sleight of hand, that is more insidious. Better to be honest and face God, stand in the battlefield face to face and meet your fate. Let God kill you. Than to play tricks on him and try to just efface him, just wipe out his personality in some subtle philosophical way. That's worse and more, it's deceitful. The honest thing is to stand face to face with your enemy. The dishonest thing is to stab him in the back. So therefore there are worse enemies of God than the actual asuras who honestly stand up against him in battle. Because what they do, what the Advaitavadis do, is they say, yes, we are also devotees of Krishna. It's very good to worship Krishna. We're also doing it. But actually, Krishna is just an illusion. It's for less intelligent people to worship God. When you're really smart, you'll give that up. You'll go beyond deity worship and personal God worship. So they're saying, we're also devotees, but they're not honest about it. They actually don't have faith, and they're pretending to have faith. That's deceit. So that kind of deceptive, stabbing in the back, that's worse than opposing someone honestly face to face. Okay, yeah. Yes, Rupa.
You said that many demons who want to fight with God, they are considered Lord as their enemies, but Lord do not consider them as his enemies.
Not in the same way.
Not in the same way.
Because he has not any hatred.
Yes, not any hatred. And he just fight with all of them just due to their devotee, like Prahlad Maharaj, that he has requested him to deliver his father.
To save his devotee?
No.
But he has other reasons too.
Other reasons too. So, in the case of Jarasandha or Kamsa, he also killed personally and many asuras in Vrindavan personally.
So?
And they considered Lord as his enemy. So Lord,
they hated him. They couldn't stand him. Just the thought of Krishna got them very agitated and angry. Just to think about it, see him or think about it. They really hated him.
So Krishna could also have managed to kill them by just natural forces. He personally killed them.
Or he could have empowered Ugrasena to stand up to Kamsa. And Ugrasena could have thrown Kamsa in jail instead of the other way around, if Krishna had empowered him. But he didn't. He let Kamsa throw Ugrasena in jail and kill the sons of Vasudeva and Devaki. He's pure devotees. Why did Krishna let Kamsa do that to Krishna's father, Vasudeva, and his mother, Devaki? He let Kamsa kill their first children, all seven children. look what Krishna let Duryodhana do to the Pandavas. Krishna allowed it. He could have stopped it. Bhima was ready. Bhima was powerful enough. But Yudhisthira said no. Bhima said, let's go kill him right now. Before we go into exile, we don't do this nonsense. Let's just kill him right now. Bhima was saying that, you know, 15 years before the Battle of Kurukshetra. But Yudhisthira said, no, it's not right. They won the gambling match and we have to go into exile. That's dharma, even though they cheated. So Yudhisthira didn't let Bhima, but if Bhima was allowed, he would have smashed Duryodhana right on the spot. Why did Krishna allow that? Why did Krishna allow Kamsa to persecute Vasudeva and Devaki? Why did he allow Duryodhana and his cohorts, his cronies, to persecute the Pandavas? For various reasons. He wants to save his devotees, but he wants his devotees to be glorified. In the case of Bali Maharaj, or rather the case of Indra, Bali stole the kingdom of heaven won it in battle from Indra. Actually, they didn't even have a battle. Bali Maharaj showed up to fight Indra outside the Amaravati. And when Indra saw the strength of Bali and his army, he just fled. He didn't even fight. And his mother was very upset. She wanted to get back the kingdom, so she worshipped Lord Vishnu, Mother Aditi. And God, Vamanadeva, was her son. But Vamanadeva won back the kingdom of Bali, not by fighting him, but by deceit. And that was fine. That was the glorious pastimes of Lord Vamanadeva. But for Bali, for Indra, that was very degrading. It was very embarrassing. That my enemy was destroyed by cheating. I couldn't even, you know, defeat him in battle. Even Vishnu didn't, on my behalf, defeat Bali, but simply tricked him. So in that case, it was not for the glory, it didn't glorify Indra at all. It made him look bad. That this little Brahmin boy, Vishnu in this form, simply played a trick and got back his kingdom for him. But in the case of the Pandavas, Krishna wanted that the Pandavas fight and get their kingdom back fairly, in a valorous way. So therefore, Krishna allowed the Pandavas to be persecuted, and by a great struggle over many years to win back their kingdom and become victorious on their own strength. That was Krishna's desire. He wanted his devotees to be glorified, not just to save them in an easy way. Similarly, Vasudeva and Devaki, although they suffered so much, losing all their children, in the end, after suffering so much anxiety, they got Krishna as their son. And they were delivered and restored to their proper position. And they enjoyed, although Krishna went away for his childhood, and when he grew up, he came back and lived with them in Dwarka. And Vasudeva and Devaki enjoyed living with Krishna later on. So Krishna has many purposes. Not just to destroy the demons in order to save the devotees. But he gives those same demons liberation. That's another purpose. To save the demons themselves. Krishna comes and kills them in person rather than just arrange Maya to destroy them. When Krishna destroys the demons in person, they get benefit, great benefit. And Krishna, the Supreme Lord, likes to enjoy a fight sometimes. It's one of the rasas. Is Virya Rasa. And along with that is Vibhatsa Rasa. You know, in battle is so much shedding of blood, carnage, and we get to enjoy the Vibhatsa, the Rasa of disgust, of horror. That means the horror of war. That's also an enjoyable experience for God and for the devotees, for some of his devotees. We're in that mood. And the Raudra Rasa, of ferociousness that's experienced in battle. So Krishna doesn't experience that with the gopis. It's completely contrary to Madhurya Rasa. They'll be shedding oceans of blood and experiencing the horror of war. But Krishna wants to enjoy that. So some devotees become his demons, his enemies. Jaya and Vijaya fell down and became demons. They're actually Vaikuntha associates of the Lord. But Krishna wanted to fight, enjoy a good fight. So his devotees came down to fight with him. That's another reason why the Lord fights with the demons and destroys them. Because he wants to enjoy fighting. Who's he going to fight with in Vaikuntha? Nobody will even say a bad word to him in Vaikuntha. What if they could stand up and fight with him? If he can't find anybody to fight with in Vaikuntha, he has to come down here to fight. But that's another purpose why the Lord fights with these demons. Multiple purposes. Many different purposes. Okay? Hare Krishna. Anything else? Yes,
please. Really, yogis, they concentrate on the Paramatma form.
Yes.
But it is mentioned in Bhagavatam that the Paramatma, they are described about Paramatma like all Vishnu forms.
Yes.
So ultimately they are concentrating on the Vishnu, so that is devotion again.
It is devotion, but it's incomplete devotion. Because in the Paramatma aspect, Vishnu is not doing very much. If I'm just standing here and I don't open my mouth, you invited me to give a lecture and I just sit here for an hour and don't say anything, then that's disappointing. You asked me to come here and speak. Like that, Vishnu has so many wonderful things he does. But the yogis who only see him as the super soul, they don't get to see those things. He doesn't do much in them. He just sits there in the heart and he gives memory, intelligence, and forgetfulness. He's the witness and the controller of our intelligence. But his wonderful leelas, his loving exchanges with his devotees, that those yogis don't get to see. So it's a kind of devotion. We can call it shantaras. They're appreciating the glory of God, but not completely, not thoroughly, because they don't see the actual activities of God beyond his just being the witness and the sanctioner, the super soul. It's the beginning of devotion, but it's incomplete.
But the purpose of devotion is to just remember Krishna always. So they are always
remember Krishna in different attitudes, in different moods. The shantarasa is only the most, like, vanilla. If you like vanilla ice cream, okay. But many people are not satisfied with just vanilla ice cream. They want some interesting flavor. Okay, so shantarasa is there, but it's the least interesting flavor of devotional service. Just appreciating God is great. What about the great things he does? The things that really make him great. He's great as a super soul. He looks very wonderful and he does a great job of witnessing all our activities. But he's got even better things than that he does. So if you like vanilla, okay. But there are other flavors also.
So is it not devotion?
Yes.
It is, yes.
Shantarasa. Which we can say that the perfect yogis who are actually realizing the super soul, we can call them Shanta Bhaktas. They're Vaishnavas. And they're practicing, if they've actually developed prema in that mood, pure love of God, even if they don't have any service relationship, then they're devotees in the relationship of Shanta, of simple passive appreciation. That's also devotional service.
Okay.
I'll accept that, yes.
But Vishwamitra Muni has fallen down, even he is doing devotional service, and how is that?
Because he wasn't practicing purely. A fall down is there because of impurity. Which one was it, Vishwamitra or... He became envious against... How do you call
it?
The Shishta. Which one became? Which one was the one that was the Rishi first, and the other one was a king? Vishwamitra and Vishishta. Vishwamitra was a king, and he wanted to become better than Vishishta, and so he wanted to become a Brahmin too, and he did it, but his motive was envy, competition. So he was not pure in the beginning. With a great struggle, he finally became very pure, but he fell down a few times in the process. He stumbled a few times. He committed aparas in the process. Eventually he became a pure devotee. If there's fall down, that's a sign that someone isn't 100% pure yet. A devotee who is 100% pure does not fall down. You see lots of people falling down because there's hardly anybody who is 100% pure. But when you have someone who is perfectly pure, an actual Paramahamsa, there's no question of falling down. He won't do it. Because he has love of God. Love of God is not a cheap thing, and hardly anybody actually has it. Is that okay?
If the yogi is 100% pure, then you won't fall down.
But the point that's being made in this verse and elsewhere is that only a devotee, a yogi who is actually a pure devotee, can be on that level of being 100% pure. Yogis who are not devotees are not pure. They've got contamination in their heart. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, Bhukti Mukti Siddhi Kami Sakali Ashant. Krishna Bhakta Nishkama Ate Eva Shanta. Those who want Bhukti, Mukti and Siddhi, those who want the karmis who want material enjoyment, the gyanis who want liberation, and the yogis who want Siddhi, they're all Ashanta, they're all dissatisfied, not peaceful in their hearts, deep in their hearts. They may look, they may pretend to be peaceful, but deep in their heart there's dissatisfaction. They cannot be satisfied as long as they're pursuing Bhukti, Mukti and Siddhi. Krishna Bhakta Nishkama. A devotee of Krishna actually has no material desire, and therefore he alone is actually peaceful, satisfied. And that dissatisfaction will drag you down eventually if you don't transcend it. So yogis who are not pure devotees of God, they are not perfect and they're liable to fall down. Okay? If you see someone fall down, that means he hasn't become perfect, and either he wasn't even trying to be a pure devotee, or he wasn't yet a perfect pure devotee, and therefore he had some problem. If he's on the path of pure devotion, then ultimately he can simply go back to his practice and again correct himself and eventually become perfect. But if he doesn't try to enter the path of pure devotion, then he's not really on the true spiritual path. It's not, whatever he's doing, it's not auspicious, according to the Kapilade. Nanyata sti shiva panta. There's no other auspicious path other than actual attempt to become a pure devotee of God. At least attempt to do it. If you fall down in the path of pure devotion, there's no harm. Because you can pick up again later. That's auspicious, to fall down in the attempt to be Krishna's pure devotee. But to not attempt it at all, that can't be auspicious. Okay. Anything else? Yes, go ahead. Yes, basically that's what it means. So two different, probably in the same purport, Prabhupada is giving two different definitions of Brahma Siddhi. One is a generic, basic definition. That it means to be realize that you're not material, you're spiritual. You're pure spirit, you're not this body. That's basic Brahman realization. But full Brahman realization is to understand you're Krishna's devotee. That's on a much higher level. It's like you do have to understand the basics. Before you can become, you know, expert in higher mathematics, you have to learn basic arithmetic. So the basic arithmetic of spiritual life is Brahmasmi. That's 1 plus 1 equals 2. You're not going to become, you know, another Einstein just by understanding 1 plus 1 equals 2. It's just the basics. Every school child who has graduated from the first grade knows that 1 plus 1 is 2. But you have to know that first. You can't talk about, you know, higher mathematics until you get the basics down. So the basics is, I'm pure spirit. Brahma Bhuta Kvasanatma. First understand you're pure spirit. Then you can become peaceful. Na shochiti na kanchiti. You can stop lamenting and hankering. Stop considering people your friends and enemies. Samat sarveshu bhuteshu. Equal to everybody. If you understand your pure spirit soul, you can come to that level. Then Mad Bhakti Madhate Param. Then you can enter the practice of pure devotion and service to Krishna. The two go together. The one kind of Brahma Siddhi is preliminary. Without that, you can't even get started. You have to realize you're not this body. That's Krishna's first teaching to Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita. And it's the first thing we have to learn. is I'm not just this material body. I have a higher purpose in life. Because I'm actually a spiritual, eternal spiritual entity. If you don't understand or accept that, then there's no spiritual life for you. Go on and be a materialist. If you really think you're just this body, well, eat, sleep, and be married. You know, because you're not, you're only going to live once. If that's what you really believe, go ahead and be a materialist. But if you're convinced that you're spirit soul, then you can start seriously thinking about practicing spiritual life. And then you can get real Brahmacity. Understanding your real Brahmacity in the full sense means to know fully that you're actually Krishna's servant. And everything you should do, you do, should be for his pleasure. They go together. One has to lead into the other. That's why Prabhupada can mention both of them in the same purport without contradicting. Both different ideas of what Brahmacity is. Yes, yes.
It said that we should always live in the glories of the Lord. So how this Hare Krishna mantra is that equal to glory? Glories means just praising God.
Oh yeah, that's all it is.
But we are just names and...
That's what pleases Krishna. We have no idea the significance of these names. Yeah. How Krishna is pleased because how those names indicate his wonderful characteristics. In some of the commentaries on the Hare Krishna mantra by Prabodhananda Sarasvati, by Jiva Goswami, by other great devotees, we get some hint of this, the actual inner significance of the Hare Krishna Maha mantra, these names of Krishna. How they actually indicate the personal, wonderful features of Krishna and the things he does. But we don't know much about that. So therefore, you know, we may doubt how just chanting this mantra, you know, really is the greatest glorification of Krishna, but it is. Nam Sankirtan is the best way to worship Krishna. That is recommended by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and by the devotees of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. The best, most effective way to get in contact with Krishna, to satisfy him, is to simply chant audibly, out loud, chant his names. Not just in your head, but actually move your tongue and vibrate his names. It's the best way to bring your mind and senses under control and to focus your attention on Krishna and to attract the attention of Krishna. You're thinking you want to see Krishna. But more important than that, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur would explain, is that Krishna should see you. And if you want Krishna to be attracted to come and see you, chant his names. Most effectively, it pleases him the most. Srinvatak Svakata Krishna Punya Shravana Kirtana. Krishna, his name is so potent. It's the most auspicious activity, simply to be vibrating his names and descriptions of his glories. It's the most beneficial thing you can do for yourself and for everybody else, is simply hear and chant the glories of the Supreme Lord, especially his names. And the Supreme Lord himself is very aware of this. He's not an egomaniac. And, you know, some politician who just wants to get his name, you know, spread around so he can get elected next time. The more he's known, the more his name is repeated, the better chance he has of getting elected. Or some movie star needs his reputation, some businessman needs to promote himself. Krishna's not some egomaniac that simply wants his fame promoted for material purposes. He wants to reclaim the fallen souls and inspire our love for him. And therefore he's pleased when we try to glorify him, because it's for our benefit. It doesn't gratify his ego. He doesn't need our glorification. He's being glorified much better by the actual pure devotees. But he wants us to also try to glorify him for our own benefit. And when he hears that we're chanting his glories, his names, and his glorification, then he's sitting inside everybody's heart. From within the heart, vidyam taksto hiya badrani, he begins purifying all our contamination of the heart from inside. He himself picks up the jaru and starts cleaning the dirty room of the heart. We're keeping our guest in the dirty room, and we're making no effort to clean the room. That's not great hospitality. Okay, you accept the guest, and you say, okay, you can stay in my house. You put him in a room and never clean it. He's there for 3 months and he never once cleaned the room. So we've had God in our hearts for many lifetimes, and we never make an attempt to clean that room, that heart, where our guest is staying. So he, but he's a very tolerant guest. He doesn't leave. No, never leaves. And we never try to clean our hearts. Still don't never try. But when he sees, oh, this person is finally vibrating my glories, chanting my names, okay, where's the jar? I'll clean the room myself. And he does. So that Krishna is most pleased by this Nam Sankirtan. Therefore, it's the most effective way to purify our hearts and to become Krishna conscious. Okay?
I read somewhere in Prabhupada that when we are sleeping, we dream. So the soul also goes into another body. For example, we dream as a tiger.
Yes.
We are thinking, imagining as a tiger.
Not the
dream.
Soul. Well, the soul, well, it's the subtle body that travels. The soul is being carried by the subtle body, by the linga sharira, when we have dreams. We travel in our subtle body.
To leave our body?
We leave the gross body, and we travel in our mental body, or linga sharira, to other parts of the universe, where whatever we're dreaming about.
And
there's a subtle connection, like an umbilical cord, connecting the subtle and gross bodies. Sometimes when you're falling asleep, you're drifting off to sleep, and all of a sudden you feel a snap and you wake up. That's that umbilical cord getting yanked back in. And you're drifting off, and all of a sudden, boop, you get pulled back into your physical body. So you experience that sometimes. If that cord connecting the subtle and gross bodies is broken, then you're dead. You can't re-enter.
But we see that person is alive at that time also, while in sleep.
Yeah, because he's still connected. His subtle body is wandering off, but there's this umbilical cord, you know, of connection with his gross body. And then, when the dream's over, he gets wound back into his material body. He returns again when he's done dreaming.
Like
wakes up and he's back in the same body, in the same room, in the same life.
It is true that the subtle body travels from in dreams.
Yeah, it does. Normally, every night. Sometimes we're sitting supposedly awake and we're daydreaming and we're going off to different places. And then, you know, sitting in the classroom and we're on the other side of the world. You know, that also happens even sometimes when we're awake. Okay.
I also read that if the Dhruva planet is there in the material world, it's eternal.
Yeah. When the sun goes down, you can see it. It's the pole star, Polaris. The Dhruva Loka, the Big Dipper, is rotating around, all the stars are rotating around Polaris, the pole star. The Big Dipper are the planets of the seven rishis, Saptarishis. You can see them, big constellation in the sky. If the sky is at all clear at night, you can see it. And in the northern hemisphere, you can always see that Dhruva Loka there, it's a bright star.
What is Shishumara?
The Shishumara is parts of several constellations around Dhruva Loka. It's made up of a collection of several stars that belong to different constellations.
So after that total devastation, the Dhruva planet will be remaining like that?
Yeah, it's actually a Vaikuntha planet. It was created by Lord Vishnu for Dhruva Loka, for Dhruva Maharaj. You can see it, it's there in the sky, you can see it every night.
Even after Brahma dies, not in one day of Brahma.
You can go to Sarekalekam station, bus station, get on a bus to Mathura, you can see a place 150 kilometers away that won't be destroyed when the universe is destroyed. Mm-hmm. Mathura district. You can go there, take the Taj Express in the morning, take a bus, 3 hours you can be there and see it yourself. Yeah, that abode. Mathura Mandala Yasmin Nityam Sanito Hari. This is Mathura Mandala, in which Lord Hari is eternally present. So he's eternally present means the place has to be there eternally. You can't be eternally present in a place that's destroyed. So Krishna says Mathura Mandala is eternal. The universe can be destroyed, it's still there. Similarly, Jagannath Puri, Navadvip Dham, these are eternal abodes of the Lord. You can go see them.
So what will happen after devastation? Where they will stay?
They will stay in unmanifest form. Yeah, they won't be visible. They have their visible aspect and their invisible aspect. Krishna is eternally performing his pastimes, all of his pastimes, in Vrindavan, on the earth. But hardly anybody can see them. Only a few very, very chosen persons can see the invisible pastimes of Krishna. But they're going on eternally. And the whole abode will become invisible, you know, at the end of the universe. Actually, it will become practically invisible after 10,000 years. That there will be no, practically no visible sign of the Vrindavan. Right now, there's hardly anything. You go to Vrindavan, you see, you know, sticker bushes, bubble trees, and yeah, and Rickshaw Lala's giving you a hard time. People trying to sell you something, rip off your money, and you know, you don't. It's hard to see the spiritual abode of Vrindavan even when you go there. But there's some signs. You know, you can see Govardhan Hill, but it's shrinking. 10,000 years ago, from 10,000 years from now, Govardhan Hill will be gone. It will shrink down, you know, under the ground, and there'll be no visible sign of it. So eventually, even before the end of the universe, the holy abode of the Lord will become invisible. And the eternal aspect of the holy abode is already invisible. When Krishna left 5,000 years ago, Vrindavan from that time on took on the aspect of a wilderness, uninhabited wilderness. So it's practically invisible even now. But in its its inner aspect, its aprakriti aspect, it's always there. See, Krishna and his devotees are eternally performing their pastimes, enjoying their pastimes there. And when the universe is destroyed, it will be there in its invisible, or its the aspect that ordinary eyes can't see. Anyway, the universe is destroyed, nobody's left. Who's going to see it anyway? There's nobody to see it anyway when the universe is destroyed. Okay? Okay, we'll stop here. Thank you. All glory to Srila Prabhupada, Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.